Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. On this podcast, we're going to talk about exercise-related case reports. Now, case reports are write-ups of a patient's clinical presentation and their course of care. These are pretty low on the hierarchy of evidence, but they can be useful for learning about how common things present uncommonly or how uncommon things present, period. And, you know, things to watch out for as a professional, whether you're in the fitness space, the medical space. And it also may help reinforce a number of important concepts and relationships related to medicine and training that we've covered on previous podcasts. The format we'll use mirrors what would actually be taking place in a hospital or a doctor's office, where pieces of the puzzle are revealed little by little. And it's fun for me because I already know these cases. I looked these cases up and I did kind of a deep dive into each of them. And Austin has no idea. So so on the other end of the line is the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Brocky. What's going on, man?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Working in the hospital in the moment, and it seems like I'm getting a little bit of extra juices flowing for some experimental podcasting here. Mystery cases. I like it.
Yeah. I do frequently read case reports and if they're published in some journals that I tend to review. And I thought this would be cool to have like a podcast series, you know, every now and then. We'll just call it case files. And this case file is number one. We'll just do case reports on exercise related things that pop up that are weird, because I think, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about fundamentals of health and pillars of health, things like checking your blood pressure, having a, you know, normal or healthy level of body fat, being active, not smoking, like things of that nature. And everyone's like, great, that's grand. Yeah, let's promote that stuff. But what about the weird things? I don't know. It allows us to really, I think it's going to allow us to really flex some like medicine and then also incorporate that into, fitness, the fitness space. So I think everybody's going to be get something out of this, and it should be, if nothing else, entertaining.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun. I'm a big fan of doing like mystery cases. I do that with a lot of my teaching, where I put myself in the hot seat sometimes, and I have a learner sometimes in a hot seat with me. And as you mentioned, this is a way for us to get beyond the fundamentals that we've been hammering for like years now without turning into, you know, athletic greens shills or something like that, and just going off the reservation in a different direction, as other podcasters do. Once they get past the basics, they start, shilling rat studies and all sorts of other nonsense. So speaking of no one in particular who's timely relevant today, but anyway.
Yeah, no, this is fine. We don't have to date this. So the format we'll use, we'll start with the initial presentation, including any relevant history that would be provided by the patient, so that if Austin was the, you know, consulting physician, or the person that he saw first, Austin would be able to get that information. And then we'll kind of pick Austin's brain, Dr. Brocky's brain, to see, hey, what are you thinking about right now as you hear this story? And then I'll introduce some vital signs, lab or imaging findings, as well as a physical exam if that's helpful to sort of further refine the differential diagnosis, the list of things that could possibly go wrong. And then we'll talk about the actual diagnosis, what happened with the patient, and we'll discuss any like clinical pearls along the way. So things that you should be aware of, things that we want you to take home from these case reports. It's not just that they're interesting. There's usually something useful here rather than like, huh, wow, that's something I'd literally never have to think of again, but thanks for the entertainment. That's not what we're doing here.
And if I recall, I heard you mention that this concept came from me referring you to one of my other favorite podcasts called The Poison Lab, which does this kind of thing on toxicology stuff, which is also fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I went down the rabbit hole of the poison. I listened to all the podcasts on there. I don't know why. I got hooked on it. So
toxicology is fascinating, man. And then hearing case reports of people like cracking open lava lamps and drinking them is like, what the hell happens to them?
That's fascinating. Yeah. I'm like, I know. And then I'm like, wait, what's in the lava lamp? What's the lava made out of? And then it's like, yeah, I mean, admittedly, you have to be pretty nerdy to kind of go down that rabbit hole. But like, we are who we are.
That's how we got here.
Yeah, that's right.
Nerds who lift. Yeah.
Nerds who lift. Yeah, we should have rebranded it. All right. Are you ready for this? Are you willing to accept this challenge?
Sure, man. Let's do it.
All right. Case number one here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast with Dr. Austin Brocky. A 28-year-old male with a 16-year history of type 1 diabetes. His A1C ranges from 8 to 12%. And for the listeners at home, a normal is less than 5.6%. He presents to the emergency room reporting palpitations and chest tightness, abdominal pain. And this has been going on for about 5 hours after he tried to work out, but he couldn't due to these symptoms. Prior to the workout, he took a product labeled pure caffeine powder that he got off the internet. He reports taking 5 grams of it, but doesn't know much else about the supplement than it claimed to, quote, increase metabolism and burn fat. Austin, what are you thinking right off the bat here?
Right off the bat, patients with type 1 diabetes are prone to a number of complications that we immediately think about and look out for when somebody comes into the emergency department. The first being life-threatening blood sugar derangements. Mostly are they having a problem with low blood sugar, sometimes complications of high blood sugar like diabetic ketoacidosis, and then of course things that can trigger that, be it related to ingestions, drug use, infections, various other medical conditions that can trigger something like that. In this case, we are furnished with the luxury of a very clear history of ingestion of what would seem to be a very high dose of presumably caffeine powder, although you have to also question whether there is something else contaminating it or whether there's some kind of a co-ingestion. And so the first thing that you'd want to do in this situation, aside from looking at the patient and seeing how do they look, what we call the eyeball test, and are they, you know, how are they breathing and things like that, but get some vital signs, get a quick finger stick blood sugar check, and then start to go down the pathway of evaluating them for both caffeine toxicity, which would manifest with a lot of kind of hyperactive, sympathetic kind of stimulant type manifestations, and then go down that potential pathway of management while also simultaneously making sure that none of those other potential contributors or triggers for complications of type 1 diabetes are going on. For example, making sure that they didn't also use any other drugs like cocaine, for example, making sure they're not having a heart attack, making sure some of those other things are ruled out as well. So that would be my first step: blood sugar, EKG, vital signs, physical exam, and go from there.
All right. Well, ask and you shall receive. So first we'll start off with the quote eyeball test. We'll talk about the physical exam. So the patient is alert, he's oriented, he's able to give you a history. And so he, you know, further expands upon this. He reports that he took the supplement for a pre-workout, but developed a really bad quote stomach ache about 40 minutes after taking it. He's progressively felt worse with nausea, a few episodes of vomiting, and he feels like he's noticed some chest tightness along with his heart, quote, beating fast. He also says he took his short-acting insulin, but skipped his evening dose of basal insulin. So with respect to vital signs, significant for an elevated heart rate into the low 100s while in bed. Respiratory rate is slightly elevated, but he's sitting normal on room air. That just means he doesn't need any supplemental oxygen. For the listeners at home, he's able to maintain a normal blood oxygen level. He looks uncomfortable and does not appear well, but the physical exam, including a focused abdominal exam, was unremarkable. Labs are significant for an elevated blood sugar of 702 milligrams per deciliter, a blood pH of 7.2. So normal blood sugar would be less than 100. His blood pH, normal blood pH would be 7.35 to 7.45. So he's below that, slightly acidic. And his anion gap was 12. So with all of that, Austin, now, what are you thinking with regarding diagnosis?
Yeah, so the things that jump out at me, his vital signs are a little bit abnormal, but not terribly so. At the same time, this patient is relatively young, and so they can kind of oftentimes deal with or compensate for a lot of things pretty well until they don't anymore. But a blood sugar of 700 is very, very elevated. A pH in the 7.2 range is low enough to definitely get my attention. And so anytime I see this combination in a patient with type 1 diabetes, regardless of any sort of co-ingestion or anything else, I'm worried about something like diabetic ketoacidosis. Up to you how far down the rabbit hole of lab interpretation we want to get. An anion gap of 12 is actually not as high as I might expect in this kind of situation. And so I'd be curious as to, you know, to delve into that a little bit further. There's also the possibility of, you know, I don't deal with a lot of caffeine overdoses, but the possibility of the caffeine via some, you know, some stimulant type effect promoting a ton of glycogen breakdown, glucose production, and then leading to hyperglycemia. And then if he's not taking enough insulin to deal with it, could it similarly be a trigger for something like diabetic ketoacidosis, which would be managed giving him a ton of fluids, giving him a bunch of insulin back, and admitting him to the hospital and going from there. And then I'd also be looking up other things that I need to be thinking about with caffeine overdose or potentially oftentimes poison control gets called by emergency physicians when they deal with this kind of thing on presentation to see from a toxicology expert, what other things do we need to be thinking about dealing with? So that's what I'd be doing up front: fluids, insulin, EKG, looking for toxicological expertise, and then maybe looking up this supplement to see if there's anything else in it in addition to the caffeine that was supposedly taken.
Well, you get a gold star. Austin, you get a gold star on this. The patient was treated for diabetic ketoacidosis with the standard protocol. So a bunch of fluids, insulin, potassium, monitoring. He was discharged 2 days later. So that brings us to actually some interesting stuff on caffeine-related safety and toxicity. So caffeine obviously is consumed in many different forms: coffee, tea, soft drinks, pills, powder in this particular case. And yeah, there's small amounts in chocolate. It's the most widely used psychoactive, pharmacologically active substance in the world. And about 85% of the U.S. population consumes at least one caffeinated beverage per day, although the average intake is about 2 cups of coffee or 165 milligrams per day. At present, there are no specific recommendations for caffeine intake in the United States, although the FDA released a letter in August 2012 stating that caffeine intakes up to 400 milligrams a day, that's like 4 to 5 cups of coffee per day, is safe for healthy adults and generally does not produce negative side effects. But that's 2012. That's over 10 years ago at this particular point. So let's talk about caffeine toxicity. And this is really interesting that you kind of like came up with this. But because I think I could have gotten there, the idea that like caffeine may promote like glycogenolysis, breakdown of glycogen and release into the bloodstream. But I guess I wouldn't feel confident about that without having like looked it up further and seen like, well, what does the evidence actually say on this in individuals with diabetes, for example? But, you know, to the point with respect to toxicity, this is like that old Paracelsus quote, like, what is there that is not a poison? All things are poison and nothing is without poison. Solely the dose determines the thing that is not a poison, or like paraphrase, the dose makes the poison.
We really had to dumb that down for modern times, I think.
Yeah, I know. When I read the original quote, I go, wait, that's the original? That's so much better. Anyway, there was a recent article that evaluated 51 caffeine-related poisoning deaths to get a better sense on dosing, what stuff's co-ingested with it, like what actual dose that people would need to actually have a sort of fatal event here. Autopsy findings with caffeine overdose are really nonspecific. The acute toxicity for caffeine is mostly related to adverse cardiovascular effects, such as cardiac arrhythmias, most specifically ventricular fibrillation. Co-ingestion was common in this case series, although the additional medications that were co-ingested were all in the therapeutic range. So it didn't look like there was like, oh, if you take caffeine with this other particular thing, you get this massive toxicity of caffeine. Now, in the case series of these 51 caffeine-related fatalities, ages ranged from 18 to 84. Some of the ingestions were accidental, whereas others were undetermined, and some were suicide. The caffeine concentration in the blood below 10 milligrams per liter is generally considered harmless. So 10 milligrams per liter or below is generally considered harmless. Concentrations of 15 to 20 are considered elevated, but still not toxic or a danger to health, whereas levels between 80 to 180 milligrams per liter are considered, or they're associated with caffeine-related fatalities. In this case series, the average accidental sort of blood level was 183 milligrams per liter, so certainly within that high range, and suicide was 185 milligrams per liter, so pretty high up there. The highest dose that they found in somebody's blood was 567 milligrams per liter, which that's a lot, as we'll see. Now, caffeine does not really redistribute itself into different tissues post-mortem, so we can do some math to try to predict the amount of caffeine needed to reach these toxic levels. Admittedly, this isn't the best method, but there's little additional information available to like currently say, oh, here's how much caffeine you'd need to take in to get to these sort of fatally associated doses. And if 80 milligrams per liter is the low end of what's been associated with caffeine-related fatalities, we can do some math here. The volume of distribution throughout the body is about 0.8 liters per kilogram. So we do some math. A 70 kilo or 154 pound individual would need to ingest 3.92 grams of caffeine to reach this threshold of 80 milligrams per liter. Or they need 8.8 grams to achieve a blood level of 180 milligrams per liter, which again was the average level in this particular case series. To put that in like practical terms, that's 39 100 milligram caffeine tablets to reach the low end. or 88 100 milligram caffeine tablets to reach the high end. Now, if we translate that to coffee, coffee can vary in caffeine concentration depending on the bean, how it's roasted, how big the, you know, the cup actually is. But in general, there's 80 to 100 milligrams of caffeine per cup. That would mean a person would need to ingest about 40 cups of coffee to get to the low end of what's been associated with the caffeine-related fatality. Now, this patient reported taking 5 grams of this, quote, pure caffeine supplement, which the case report claims is about 2,500 milligrams of caffeine or 25 cups of coffee. So not really at that fatal dose. And this patient obviously did fine afterwards. So that kind of led me down the rabbit hole of like, what happens with blood sugar with respect to caffeine ingestion? So in the short term, you're exactly right. Blood sugar does seem to go up with caffeine ingestion, particularly in individuals with diabetes. But that's kind of counteracted by beta cell functioning improving. They actually spit out a little bit more insulin if they can. Not in this particular case, it's type 1 diabetes. And insulin sensitivity also seems to improve a little bit. So there is some sort of like compensatory stuff going on there. And in fact, with chronic consumption, insulin sensitivity seems to improve with caffeine ingestion and risk of developing type 2 diabetes, to be clear. And its disease burden seems to go down. So there's like this acute short-term effect where blood sugar can go up, but the long-term chronic effects of ingesting caffeine, especially if it's from coffee, seems to actually be a positive benefit here. So in this overdose situation, this acute effects of caffeine seem to predominate for this particular individual. And to your point earlier, likely skipping that basal dose really seemed to kind of put him over the edge. He had like this big increase in blood sugar. And then because he didn't take his basal dose, it was like, ah, dang, now you got DKA. So,
yeah. Yeah. Interesting case. Glad I was able to get there. And I would say, you know, it is actually much easier than you would think to get toxic from caffeine when you're taking it in that pure, you know, caffeine anhydrous powder form. So I effectively recommend that never to anyone to use. It's very, very easy to end up with too much. And, you know, you mentioned the equivalent of like 40 cups of coffee or something like that, which would have to be all ingested very quickly to mimic the amount of caffeine ingested. And you would die of water intoxication from drinking that much coffee before you died from the caffeine effect. You'd probably have a seizure from acute hyponatremia after drinking 40 or 50 cups of coffee, like within, you know, in the same amount of time that you could take a scoop of caffeine powder, which would be all at once. So anyway, interesting case.
Yeah, the case series on the caffeine-related fatalities, they suggest that most of the intake was due to caffeine tablets.
Yeah.
Because again, you just can't do the fluid. Yep. And so for people listening home, we're not saying that caffeine before a workout is bad. And in fact, the like performance-enhancing dose, if you were going to, you know, use this to improve your workout, is somewhere between 3 to 6. Some studies would say 3 to 9, but feel more comfortable at 3 to 6 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram body weight about an hour before a workout. And if you're not used to using caffeine, we would recommend erring towards the lower end of that side and then kind of work up to whatever you feel is most beneficial. But the average cup of coffee, again, is about 100 milligrams of caffeine. So this is, you know, 2 cups of coffee for some folks. And then if you weigh a little bit more, maybe it's close to 2.5 cups or 3 cups of coffee. But again, I would err towards the lower end compared to the higher end. And I would not use caffeine powder or caffeine pills. And that they tend to take even longer actually to reach like peak effect anyway. So like the hot coffee seems to be like the perfect vehicle to transmit caffeine to you.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know. I mean, if it comes in your pre-workout already, like it's like you take PeriRx, for example, we have caffeine in there. Great. But you don't like taking actually caffeine powder. To me, that seems like a toxicological situation just waiting to happen, especially if there's kids, you know, in the house or something like that.
Yeah. And the last consideration is, you know, why you would want to take that much caffeine before a workout, because the data on how big of a performance boost you're going to get is not massive as it is with most supplements. And additionally, you're trading off likely, unless you're doing this training like pretty early in the morning, you may even be trading off some like sleep impairment if you're doing this later in the day, that this caffeine, especially if you have 2 cups of coffee, like in the late afternoon, early evening, and you're trying to sleep, like go to sleep a couple hours later, it is likely to be disrupting your sleep. And so that may be a net negative for you too. So things to think about.
Yeah. And you mentioned something also, you were like, yeah, depending on what the rest of his clinical picture looked like or, you know, labs and such, you may go down the rabbit hole of calling the poison lab or poison center and being like, hey, what else could possibly be in this thing causing this clinical picture? Because like if his LFTs were off the liver function tests were off the chart, or it looked like he had some other sort of like, you know, toxidrome, you'd be like, well, what was this thing adulterated with? What, you know, we know that supplements in general, the supplement industry lacks regulation, and that a, you know, good chunk of supplements available, particularly in the United States, because we can get them not only from places from manufacturers in the United States, but also from elsewhere. A good portion of them are adulterated, contaminated, mislabeled, and so on. You know, we estimate that 20% of all dietary supplements available for purchase are likely contaminated, although that's probably an underestimation due to underreporting, lack of research, you know, into this topic, and more than that are mislabeled. So I guess I'm wondering, when you call the poison center and you're like, hey, man, this guy's got these signs and symptoms, we took a supplement, do you think they're keyed up on like potential supplement adulterants, or they're more just thinking of like, here's the stuff we know. This seems like a typical toxidrome that we're familiar with.
Yeah, I think much more so it's going to be what are the features that you're seeing in front of you that can be fully explained by the supposed ingestion. In other words, if everything that this patient is manifesting looks, sounds, smells exactly like a caffeine overdose, then and that's what they're telling you they took, okay, we'll probably manage it as such with this, you know, best practices and hopefully that the patient recovers. But to the extent there are features that don't fit just an isolated caffeine ingestion, then you'd start to think, okay, what other things can cause these kind of manifestations? So if there are certain changes on his, you know, EKG or certain other changes in certain lab parameters, it might be like, I wouldn't expect caffeine by itself to do that. Let me think about what other things could be going on here, or how I might get closer. Do I need to do some other testing for certain other things, or will it just continue to get better with supportive care, which is honestly what a lot of toxicological management involves, is good supportive care. But sometimes there are things that you might ingest that require specific dedicated treatment. Like if somebody tends to, you know, if somebody ends up with a Tylenol overdose, that requires very specific treatment to, you know, oftentimes save that person's life or other sorts of ingestions beyond just basic supportive care. So, the other things is poison control. Calling them for any sorts of these sorts of ingestions is useful, not only for guidance on what to do, but it helps them because they maintain databases on, like, you know, statistical data on, so what sorts of ingestions are happening, and that's how we can kind of catch trends in certain places and identify, you know, are there certain things that are, you know, commercial products that are contaminated because we're seeing an outbreak of, you know, poisonings in a particular area, and then that can help the institution get to the bottom of it, and then public awareness and things like that. So there are lots of reasons why we take advantage of that resource in practice day to day.
Yeah, if you were wondering, is there like a caffeine reversal agent? Unfortunately, no. And so if somebody had like a significant toxicity just due to caffeine with no other, you know, thing requiring supportive care, they really had a super high level of caffeine, the treatment's hemodialysis, right? And plus you call cardiology and you get them on board, and if there's a dysrhythmia, you know. And so it's just kind of like, yeah, we can't just give you something to like, oh, well, kind of OD'd on the old caffeine here. There's just, have to get it out of the system somehow. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, interesting case nonetheless. I was like, are people really overdosing on caffeine? I guess it's possible.
Sure are.
Okay. For all the golfers in the audience, you've probably heard of PXG by seeing them on the PGA Tour in the hands of guys like Joel Damon, Zach Johnson, and Luke List. Well, they're bringing that same passion for excellence to their new line of apparel, and I got to say, they nailed it. I just got another polo from them, and both the fit and performance are excellent. They're really versatile as well, meaning I can wear them out to eat or take a meeting, and without signaling to everyone that I'm about to play golf. Now, PXG apparel has something for everyone. They got pants, polos, sweaters, hats, quarter zips, joggers, jackets, skirts, everything you could want. I've got a few of their hats and a few of their polos, but some of their mid layers look great too. We've got a special offer for our audience. If you're looking to elevate your style game on and off the course, check out the PXG Spring and Summer 2024 collections. Head over to pxg.com/barbell and use the code barbell at checkout to save 10% on all apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell. That's code B-A-R-B-E-L-L to save 10% on apparel. That's pxg.com/barbell.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5hourenergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Case 2 on Case Files, episode number 1. All right, so this is a 23-year-old male with no significant past medical history. He presents to the emergency department with a 6-hour history of pain and swelling in both shoulders. One day ago, the patient was lifting weights for a, quote, really long time, and he says they were heavier weights than normal. declined to say how much because he saw you in the room, and he's like, I can't tell this man how much I was lifting. Afterwards, the pain and swelling in his shoulders has progressively gotten worse later into the evening, and it was so bad that he couldn't sleep despite taking NSAIDs. He denies injury or trauma to the area, and he has no surgical history. He's not taking any medications. He denies taking any supplements. He says his shoulder pain is mostly on top and in his traps, and he says it's 10 out of 10 at rest. So right off the bat, Austin, what are you thinking about?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, what we would suspect is going on in this case, be it related muscular injury related to exertion like rhabdomyolysis would be at the front of mind if I wanted to flex and illustrate a very broad differential diagnosis for somebody presenting with bilateral shoulder pain. The first things would typically be musculoskeletal or orthopedic in nature. That could include something like a muscular issue like rhabdomyolysis or some kind of inflammatory muscle disease, or an orthopedic bony type issue, which would be less likely to happen symmetrically in both shoulders, but is certainly possible. And then the you know, less common thing, particularly in somebody who's 23 years old, would be some sort of a cardiovascular manifestation, be it related to the heart or the aorta or something like that, which is because sometimes symptoms like of heart attacks, for example, chest pain can radiate to both shoulders and things. So I would be asking about other symptoms like that. In this case, again, kind of like the last one where the patient told us a very clear history of, hey, here's what I took too much of. Here we have a, here's what I did too much of and precipitated my acute shoulder pain, which was bilateral. And so I'd be, you know, wondering whether he had an actual acute bilateral shoulder injury, something musculoskeletal or orthopedic that affected both shoulders at the same time, or whether this is purely a muscular issue like rhabdomyolysis that is manifesting primarily with symptoms in the shoulder area.
All right. Well, before we get to labs, imaging, and some other workup, let's talk about the physical exam. I know you're a huge fan of the physical exam and its diagnostic utility. Big, big champion of the physical exam.
Sometimes.
And this, sometimes, that's right.
Less often than we'd like.
That's right. So on exam, the patient appears distressed. His vital signs were significant for a blood pressure elevated to 144 over 99, but otherwise vital signs were normal. A focused examination of the shoulders revealed impressive swelling, redness, warmth, and extreme tenderness to palpation over both trapezius and supraspinatus muscles. Pulses, capillary refill, hand grip strength, biceps, and tricep strength are all normal. Shoulder strength and range of motion were severely limited due to pain, particularly with arm abduction. In the emergency department, the patient received 4 total doses of Dilaudid prior to exam and was still unable to move his shoulders. Any new guesses before we get into the laboratory results here?
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff could be consistent with like a muscular exertion related issue. I will say that most of the time we don't see that much like redness and like a profound amount of swelling in an area. It's certainly possible, but that, you know, that also raises the possibility of other things that I've seen. For example, if you had certain types of orthopedic or musculoskeletal injuries, there could be bleeding into the area. It could have like some hematomas, could have some other fluid accumulation, or some kind of a, you know, sometimes, for example, if, when patients have a like a biceps tear, then the muscle kind of rolls up in the arm and it generates this kind of swollen bulge that's very unhappy. And so all of these things, musculoskeletal, orthopedic, rhabdomyolysis type injuries, whether there's any fluid, bleeding, accumulation in the area, soft tissue, edema, things like that would be the main things that I'd be thinking about at this point.
All right. Well, let's talk about some labs and some imaging, see what Dr. Baraki thinks. So first up here, his CK is creatine kinase is 22,000, normal being 55 to 170. So already you were right off the tip. Rhabdomyolysis, it seems probable.
Yeah, I agree. A CK of 22,000 is pretty elevated. It's not something that shocks me in terms of how high it is. I think when we did our rhabdo episode, I've talked about patients I've seen with like 130, 140,000 CKs. That was much scarier, but definitely gets my attention. Now, a CK by itself is not enough to diagnose rhabdomyolysis. And so that's why I want the rest of the syndrome and the patient coming in with a clear exertion history, pain, swelling, you know, potentially some other symptoms. Would increase my suspicion that that is in fact what's going on. Just given the last thing I would mention, you know, in other areas of the body, you can get infections in the soft tissues, and that can lead to swelling and this kind of pain and things like that, or things like compartment syndrome in certain areas. All of this stuff would be a little bit unusual to happen symmetrically in the trapezius and shoulder area, but those were some other additional thoughts that I had.
Well, the emergency room doc thought that the physical exam was so impressive, particularly due to the tenderness and the pain with movement, despite no obvious trauma to the area, that they decided to do an ultrasound of the shoulders, which showed massive edema in both the supraspinatus muscles bilaterally. And so they decided to check the pressure in these compartments.
There you go.
So in the trapezius, both the pressure was 24 and 25 millimeters of mercury. Normal is 3 to 20, so slightly elevated in both of the trapezius muscles. But in the supraspinatus muscles, the left supraspinatus muscle was 56 millimeters of mercury, so much higher than the normal range, and it was 85 millimeters of mercury in the right supraspinatus muscle. So the diagnosis, which you got there before I even had to tell you.
Just in time.
Just in time. Compartment syndrome plus rhabdomyolysis. So this patient, orthopedics was consulted, and they actually requested an MRI, and that showed, again, massive edema of the supraspinatus muscles bilaterally. So the patient was taken to surgery. They had a fasciotomy to release the pressure in the compartment. There was no necrosis, so this resulted in a complete relief of pain upon the patient waking up from surgery. For the rhabdomyolysis, the patient received a lot of IV fluids and was discharged from the hospital after 6 days. In a one-year follow-up, the patient was pain-free, active in sports. He was still lifting weights, full range of motion, had no pain and weakness. Any thoughts on this case before we dive into some of these pearls here?
Interesting. I mean, I think that I suspect I would have probably been similarly concerned as the ER doc if I saw that exam in person. It's definitely hearing it through words. I'm trying to like paint this picture in front of me, and obviously it takes maybe an extra step to get there, but glad I did. In practice, this is in my opinion, a super unusual location to develop compartment syndrome in the trapezius and like shoulder musculature. I don't know if any orthopods would feel differently or if they've seen it more often, but I find that to be pretty interesting, pretty unusual, but definitely glad that somebody thought to check those pressures and to go from there. Like I mentioned, you know, rhabdomyolysis was the first thing that came to mind, but hearing that exam is not necessarily the typical exam that we see with it. And so that's kind of like the last case where we talked about, hey, did they say it's caffeine and everything looks like caffeine? Cool, treat it like caffeine. Here it was like, did it sound like rhabdo? Sure. Did it look like rhabdo? Maybe not. Maybe I need to think about another possibility here. And that added a little bit more to the diagnostic picture. What did you say the exercise was that he was doing?
He did not, they don't report like what kind of exercises that he was,
I'm like, what was he pressing though?
Was he pressing? Was he doing shrugs, a bunch of lateral raises? Like, what was the deal? But yeah, to your point though, I try to put myself in that position too. Like, you go in, you see an exam and you're like, okay, the patient's shoulders are edematous, they're swollen, they're tender, red, warm. Bilaterally, huh? Because like rhabdo, you're like, all right, yeah, the muscles can be tender, sure. And if somebody, you know, just worked out or recently worked out, they could still be a little swollen, but red, warm. And then you're like, infection bilateral, huh? What? How did that happen? To your point, compartment syndrome doesn't seem like something that would be on the front of your mind. And I curbsided one of my ortho friends to be like, hey man, you ever seen compartment syndrome in the supraspinatus muscles? He's like, literally never, but it's always possible and technically on the differential if you get a picture like that. And I was like, would you have guessed rhabdo just by reading this case report? And he's like, not until I did maybe a physical exam and got a wild hair to check a pressure on this patient. So
yeah, I think part of it, the thing that's odd is that you don't really think about that as much of an enclosed compartment as you do in the forearms and in the lower legs or the extremities, basically. So we think about, you know, we learn about these fascial compartments in school and everything in the arms and the legs, which is a much more common place for these things to happen. And I don't know that we learn about similar fascial compartments in the trapezius and shoulder girdle in the same way. And so that's why you'd be like, oh, it just has all this space to expand if it needs to. What's the enclosing compartment?
Yeah, what's the deal?
Clearly there is one. So yeah, cool case. Interesting.
Yeah. Let's talk about rhabdo a little bit. Then we'll talk about compartment syndrome and then move on to our third case.
Sure.
So rhabdo, as you mentioned, now this is a complex medical condition involving the rapid breakdown of damaged or injured skeletal muscle tissue, leading to direct release of the intracellular muscle contents. In a clinical sense, rhabdomyolysis is characterized by this triad of myalgias, that's muscle pain, muscle weakness, and red to brown urine due to myoglobin that's released from the muscle into the blood and then subsequently into the urine. However, less than 10% of cases actually have this triad, and over half of patients do not report muscle pain or weakness. So again, this is a clinical diagnosis. It's like you learn this classic triad, but the triad's not that classic. Mm-hmm. You're like, no red urine, no blood, no brown urine, no Coca-Cola urine. Like, come on, can't be rhabdo. But yeah, it's just a clinical diagnosis. And as you mentioned, you know, typically rhabdomyolysis results from a specific, quote, insult to the muscle. So this would be overexertion in this particular case. And it leads to this large amounts of muscle damage and subsequent breakdown. These insults can be anything from like an overzealous workout, particularly from stuff that the individual is not accustomed to. But it can also occur from a crush injury, from surgery with prolonged immobilization, particularly if there's like a vascular occlusion from like a cast or a dressing or something like that, burn or electrical injuries, but also things like heat illness, seizures, myopathies, autoimmune diseases, and so on. There's a number of different ways you can get this. But after the insult to the muscle, effectively the muscle is damaged and it releases all of its intracellular contents, including myoglobin. That's the thing that carries oxygen in the muscle, but also sodium, calcium, and high levels of potassium. So there are a lot of potential negative outcomes that can happen as a result of myoglobin. It's not the creatine kinase itself, which is like this lab that we kind of look for. See if somebody has rhabdomyolysis. That's not particularly harmful. It's more just an indicator of like what's going on. Mm-hmm. Having super high levels of potassium, calcium, sodium, and then myoglobin's effect on the kidney, those are the real sort of nefarious, you know, actors here. When you're treating somebody for rhabdo, Austin, like what are your main concerns as far as like, okay, we need to avoid this happening. That's why we're giving this person fluids and treating them for rhabdomyolysis.
Yeah, probably the biggest things are their kidney function and their potassium levels more than anything else. There are certain risk scores that we sometimes use to like estimate somebody's risk of going into renal failure and potentially even needing dialysis. But definitely, you know, the cases that I've seen, it typically involves managing them with a lot of fluids, making sure their electrolytes are okay, because that can impact how well your heart functions. And then, yeah, thinking about it, most often when we see rhabdo, if it is involving an extremity, you know, I've seen it like in the quads or in the calves or in the forearms. Those are the situations where I'm like definitely on point, checking pulses and their sensation and making sure that they're not developing what could be signs of compartment syndrome on top of their rhabdo. So that's where we think about it much more readily than I would in somebody's shoulders. But now I'll think about that too.
Yeah, it you know, one thing that's interesting about the treatment for rhabdomyolysis is that, yeah, you are in general given a lot of IV fluids, and then there's some risk of developing compartment syndrome
because the fluids can leak out. Yep.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, into the space. So let's talk about compartment syndrome. Now, acute compartment syndrome was first described by Richard von Volkmann. This is a German physician in 1881, where an injury to the forearm, like a crush or fracture, compromised the muscles and blood flow to the arm and hand. It resulted in a claw-like presentation of the hand and sometimes a flexed wrist, along with other deficits. This is now called Volkmann's ischemic contracture. Basically, you get this claw hand in response to this injury that effectively cut off blood supply to the muscles, the nerves, and you get this resulting contracture of the hand. Acute compartment syndrome, which is a different kind of ACS. Austin, can you imagine you're reading a note and somebody just wrote ACS of the forearm and you're like, wait, what?
If orthopedics is writing ACS and it's not coronary syndrome, then yeah, I have to think twice about that.
Yeah, acute compartment syndrome. So this is defined as a critical pressure increase within a confined compartmental space, causing a decline in the perfusion pressure to the tissue within that compartment. That's a fancy way of saying like the blood flow, blood supply to the muscles, to the nerves or whatever has been compromised due to an increase in pressure. So you can get an increase in pressure above this sort of threshold, critical threshold, if you will, by a number of different ways. One, you can have bleeding into the area. You can have increased fluids, like if you're administering a ton of fluids to somebody, they get trapped there. Crushing, or compression of the existing space, so via like trauma or, again, a pressure dressing or a cast or something like that. You can just get damage to the actual muscle in and of themselves, and they don't have anywhere to expand. There's a lot of different ways to get this sort of increase in pressure. Now, compartment syndromes can arise in any area of the body that has little or no capacity for tissue expansion. But as you mentioned, Austin, the most common area is the lower leg, usually via a tibial shaft fracture, and then the forearm is the second most common. But other compartments where this can happen are the foot, the buttocks, and the abdomen. You're probably more familiar with the like abdominal, the acute abdomen.
Yeah, I've seen a fair amount of abdominal compartment syndrome, usually when patients accumulate a ton of fluid in their belly, like from liver disease and things like that. And post-operative scenarios too can do that.
Yeah. So typical causes, things like fracture, crush injuries, penetrating trauma, where it's the penetrating thing is stuck in there and again taking up space. Constrictive dressings and casts, like we said, burns, infection, bleeding disorders like hemophilia, for example, just bleeding into the muscle and it gets trapped, and more. Again, the elevated pressure compromises the blood flow, the nerve function, and ultimately can cause cell death or necrosis. Now, diagnosis is clinical for acute compartment syndrome with the five P's that are classically taught as pain, pallor, pulselessness, paralysis, and paresthesia. But the pulselessness and paralysis are rare, particularly early in the case.
You hope you don't see those because it's too late.
Yeah. But classically, we're taught like the buzz phrase is like pain out of proportion to injury, pain out of proportion. You know, anytime you see that, you're like, compartment syndrome? What is this? And pain with passive stretching of the muscles are typically better indicators. But again, clinical suspicion is needed. Now, compartment pressure can be measured if there's doubt. Again, normal is about 10 millimeters of mercury, and then 30 millimeters of mercury is considered the clinical threshold above which circulation is compromised. Now, this guy's supraspinatus muscles, one was 56 and the other was 85, so far above that sort of threshold. Again, the treatment is surgical fasciotomy, but it better be quick. You can't really wait. There's actually some controversy about performing fasciotomies, you know, if there's been like a delay of like 8 hours or more because, there can be other complications of waiting that long.
I was a little surprised when you mentioned in the case that they got pressures that high and then the orthopedic team asked for an MRI, because that adds probably several hours of waiting before you can cut the muscle belly open.
Yeah. And they actually mentioned that in the case report, that like the need for an MRI is, you know, usually not recommended. And so I was wondering, like, why did they want that? Maybe they didn't. Maybe they're like, you know, not only just like you, but like us, and like, supraspinatus?
Yeah.
Compartment syndrome?
I mean, I can hypothesize. Maybe they were wondering if there was, for surgical planning, if there were any other injuries that they were going to have to manage. For example, if there was a muscle tear, if a ligamentous injury, tendinous injury, or a fracture or something like that, that they would want to know before they went in. That's on one hand, I can see that. On the other hand, if you have an urgent scenario like that ought to be decompressed, you can get probably for the most part good enough pictures with a CT scan to at least tell you, is there anything else major that I need to deal with? And then the soft tissue stuff, if you need to go back in and deal with that later, then that would be fine. But that's my best guess as to
as to why that happened.
Yeah.
There's also a related condition called exertional compartment syndrome, where there's an elevated, again, pressure within the compartment space, but in the absence of trauma. So this chronic exertional compartment syndrome occurs in the setting of recurrent but reversible ischemic episodes following cessation of activity, resulting in the predictable decrease in fascial compartment pressures. This is common in sports involving a lot of running, also in like military recruits. And your boy here personally suffers from chronic exertional compartment syndrome when I ride dirt bikes. And it is the wildest experience. And when I try to explain it to people who have not experienced it, they're like, what in the world? It's like, I'm on my dirt bike. I start off, I am fresh. My resting heart rate is in the 50s. And then I get on my dirt bike. I get a little scared off the bat. And now it's in the 70s or 80s. I get out on the track. I am exerting myself. And yeah, my heart rate goes up, usually in the 130s to 150s. And then if I'm really pushing it, gets much higher, closer to 170s. So sure, I am exerting myself. But the wildest damn thing, my forearms become like cinder blocks, like rock solid, pumped. It's not like a cool muscle pump. You're like, oh man, awesome. But they get so pumped up that it's painful, but then my hands go numb. I lose the ability to like move my hand in any sort of like fine motor control. So twisting the throttle becomes difficult. Turning off the throttle becomes difficult. Grabbing the front brake, grabbing the clutch lever. And so you just imagine you're on a off-road course with jumps, obstacles, other riders that you're trying to navigate at some high rate of speed, and you can't use your hands.
Is it your dexterity? Kind of, it reminds me of when you're out in like freezing cold and your finger movements are just slower than normal. Like you can't do anything quickly with your fingers or dexterous.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it's not only slower, but also like painful. And so you're just trying to like, the only choice there is really just to stop.
Yeah.
If you want to regain like full motor control. But doing that in the middle of a race, well,
ill-advised. Yeah.
Ill-advised. Yeah. And so this is something, what they do for that is they perform a fasciotomy. It's not emergent. It's elective, mm-hmm. right? So you're like, all right, look, I have this thing and, you know, they can go in and release the pressure. The problem is sometimes that where they make the incisions, like the forearm, there's three incisions that they make, three to four usually, that can scar down and actually get worse, actually mm-hmm. make the compartment smaller. And so people will have to have like revisions of these procedures. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing to your point, because you were like, why does he have bilateral shoulder, you know, issues? That's unusual. Well, in fact, in chronic exertional compartment syndrome, it typically is bilateral.
Yeah, and so you're assuming you're doing a symmetrical activity.
Yeah. Yeah. The pathophysiology is super weird. We don't really know what it is. Maybe it's decreased fascial elasticity of the compartments, fluid overload. Though, yeah, again, the relatively little evidence to support unique interventions that are non-surgical. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm either going to stop riding at some point or like get this procedure done or just keep – I mean, I've been doing it my whole life and I just deal with it. It's just not very fun. So. Yeah. Okay, that was our second case. You get a gold star again. Like
two for two.
Again, two for two. All right, final case here on our case files number one, first episode. Another young man for you. All right, 23-year-old male presents to the military emergency department with left shoulder pain after deadlifting quote heavy weights the previous evening. His review of systems is negative, and he has no past medical or surgical history. This is, I guess, he was seen in Fast Track, so very limited history.
Yeah.
Initial thoughts right off the bat here? Left shoulder pain after deadlifting. What do you think?
Yeah, so typically when we have a localized complaint like this, knowing that, if I briefly ignore all the rest of the history, how would I approach something like this? We need some kind of an organized system to approach this. So we tend to do it in an anatomic fashion. So I think about, you know, the musculoskeletal aspect, including the osteoarticular kind of component, meaning the shoulder joint, the musculature around the shoulder, the tendons, the ligaments, all that good stuff. And then if I were dealing with just a general medical patient, what are the other things that can either manifest with shoulder pain or refer pain to the shoulder, including underlying medical issues? Pain can be referred to the shoulder from the neck, from the upper spine, from the heart, from the gallbladder. Abdominal stuff can refer symptoms in that direction, and then other weirder things. Again, in this case, we have not a super detailed history, but a relatively clear temporal relationship of this shoulder pain onsetting after a particular exertional activity. And so I'm mainly focusing in on the musculoskeletal, osteoarticular kind of component of the shoulder. And so the next steps that I would want really would be to look at this thing, look at the shoulder, examine it, range it, see if there's any signs that I need to pursue further evaluation, or if this is just what we'll call, acute shoulder pain and call it good and give them some conservative management. But I suspect this might take an interesting turn. We'll see.
That's right. Yeah. So the physicians who saw him in the emergency room thought the same. So vital signs were normal. Patient appears well and not distressed. They did a focused left shoulder exam, which was normal with respect to range of motion, strength, and appearance. So the clinicians were like, huh, that's funky. Let's expand our thought process here. Let's
do
a full physical.
This is going to be like a pneumothorax or something, isn't it?
So they did an abdominal exam. When they got to the abdominal exam on the patient, they noted mild tenderness to palpation in the left upper quadrant. There was no guarding or rebound.
Yeah.
So they decided to send some labs and do a mm-hmm. little bit of imaging. So right now, before we go any further, has this refined your thought process at all?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that other things can refer pain to the shoulder, including abdominal things. So classically on the right side, gallbladder can refer to shoulder blade and shoulder. Heart can go to either shoulder on the left side, left upper side. I'd be thinking about the spleen potentially referring It's the odd thing is the acuity of it in terms of how quickly it sounds like that the pain onset, which can sometimes be a clue to what's going on. In other words, did something sudden happen to the spleen, for example? Did, you know, if I asked more detailed history, maybe this young, you know, military person had something like mononucleosis and got back to physical activity too soon, maybe took an impact that he didn't realize and had a acute splenic rupture or something like that, which would be unusual, but I'm trying to match it with the speed that this onset. There are certain other less common things that can happen to impact the spleen, which is in that left upper quadrant. The other thing is, just because somebody has some left upper quadrant abdominal discomfort doesn't mean that what's going on is in the abdomen. It could also be in the chest, in the lower part of the lung, on the diaphragm, or right there. So sometimes, for example, like I mentioned, somebody had a pneumothorax in that area, partially collapsed lung, or a pulmonary embolism, or some fluid accumulation, pneumonia in that left lower lung, that could also manifest in the same area. I would expect with those things the person to have some pain in that area when they presented, but they don't have to. It can manifest with pain in the shoulder as well. So I'm thinking about things that are in that left upper area, lower lung, diaphragm, spleen. What are things that can impact that? Like I said, collapse of the lung, clot, infection, fluid. Splenic pathologies can be something like mononucleosis, rare cases like a splenic infarct and embolus from endocarditis. Like, I'm going down the rabbit hole. This is the kind of stuff that I would see and think about day to day. The probability of these things is not incredibly high, but if I have somebody with bad shoulder pain and a completely normal shoulder exam, but I did find this in his abdomen, I'm definitely going to have to broaden to weirder things. I guess the only other thing I haven't touched on in that left area, if it's more in the front or in the back, on the back aspect, you start to think about kidney related pathology. But again, that manifesting in the shoulder, a bit odd. Definitely, even that's even more weird. But all right,
hit me. Well, unfortunately, this case report did not have a detailed account of all of the things that they did, but what they do report is that the patient had a normal H&H, so hemoglobin, hematocrit, that was normal. Their ultrasound of the abdomen, they did a FAST exam actually on this person because they were worried about trauma with the abdominal findings that they had, showed free fluid in the left upper quadrant and an enlarged spleen. So then they further sent some more laboratory tests, and he was monospot positive.
Nailed it.
Yeah. Got there. So the course for this patient, general surgery was consulted. They diagnosed him with a grade 3 splenic laceration secondary to mononucleosis. He was admitted. He was stable overnight. He was discharged the next day. Follow up 2 weeks later in clinic, and symptoms were improving. So interestingly, despite I thought, because the history, the lab, everything else, there was so small, so little, so few. I was like, no way. He's not going to get it.
You thought you were going to stump me? Well, I guess I'm okay at my job, huh?
Yeah, I guess job security. So let's talk about mono here. So Austin, when you're probably not seeing a lot of people turn up to the ED for mono, you know?
Oh, I sure do.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah, interesting. I can talk a little bit about it. And the main reason is that because a lot of times these patients have they can have pretty significant lab derangements. And when they show up with pretty significant lab derangements, the ER often calls me. This most recently happened like a month or so ago, and I had a young guy come in with kind of a mono-type syndrome, and his liver enzymes were very elevated. And mononucleosis is a particular diagnosis, but there are multiple mononucleosis-like illnesses. And that can be caused by a variety of different infections, most classically Epstein-Barr virus or EBV, but it can also come, you can have a similar syndrome coming from other viruses like CMV, HIV, adenovirus, strep, various other HHV, I forget which one, 6 maybe can cause this. So a bunch of different viruses and some bacteria even can cause this syndrome. And so, I've seen lots of young guys with really significant lab derangements, super abnormal blood counts, super abnormal liver function tests. And so that often spooks people and I get called. And if it looks like a plain slam dunk case of mono, then we just say, hey, take a look at their spleen. If it's enlarged, give them some contact precautions so they don't get, you know, take a helmet to the left side and send them on their way, and they'll be okay. But other times patients can get a little bit sicker from it or have other complications like this splenic rupture situation.
Yeah. So infectious mononucleosis is typically fever, tonsillar pharyngitis, sore throat, due to the tonsils being enlarged, and then lymphadenopathy. So people, their lymph nodes and lymph tissue become swollen. It's also known as glandular fever, as you referenced, typically caused by Epstein-Barr virus or EBV. It tends to peak at between the ages of 15 to 24, based on historical data, which is now like 20 or 30 years old now. And 90 to 95% of adults are seropositive for Epstein-Barr virus. Like they've had it already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Typically spread by saliva, but it's not particularly contagious. The virus itself can actually shed in the oropharynx for up to 18 months after recovery. So like the people, if you had it, like you not only are going to have it for the, you know, be seropositive for the rest of your life, but you can be shedding for a significant period of time. Now, symptoms can range from mild to severe, and atypical presentations are also noted, as you mentioned. But the sore throat, pharyngitis, the swollen lymph nodes, fever, fatigue, and so on are pretty common. Treatment is generally supportive, Tylenol or NSAIDs for throat discomfort, although there's some controversy about actually treating people who have fever with Tylenol and NSAIDs because that may actually prolong the symptomatic duration. But, you know, people generally feel crummy when they have a mono that they're aware of. And yeah, as you mentioned, sometimes atypical infections, whether it's, you know, HIV or whether it's, you know, adenovirus or whatever, require additional workup and management because it's like, okay, you don't have Epstein-Barr, you have something else, and that may require additional treatment. What people might want to know is like, hey, isn't this a virus? Can't we just do like antivirals? Like, you know, won't that just fix it? This has actually been studied and no benefit compared to placebo. So yeah, like you can give people antivirals, but there's just no benefit to doing so. Now, how this works is that the Epstein-Barr virus infects the B cells of the immune system, which then are widely distributed throughout the lymph nodes and other involved tissues like the spleen. Now, spleen is this fist-sized organ in your upper left side of your abdomen next to your stomach, but behind your left ribs. It's a very important organ to the immune system for your red blood cells, platelets, and more. And with infectious mononucleosis, just over half of patients will actually have splenomegaly, so a large spleen, which typically presents with pain. Now, for those who have splenomegaly, sometimes the spleen can actually rupture. And interestingly, of those who do have splenic rupture or laceration in this particular case, about half do so spontaneously without trauma. So it's just like we know there's this risk and, you know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. Now, for atraumatic splenic rupture, it's thought that the diseased spleen is susceptible to minor injury. So the infection and engorgement of the spleen itself cause micro tears and weakening of the splenic capsule, which is susceptible to increased venous pressure from a high intra-abdominal pressure. And so documented cases of splenic rupture are from sneezing, a snowball fight, actually being hit with a snowball. But this is the first one that's been reported with resistance training. Now, and further, there are different grades of splenic injury. So you can look up the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma. They have a splenic injury scale ranging from grade 1 through grade 5. The current recommendations for athletes with infectious mononucleosis is that they should all refrain from sport for 3 to 4 weeks, as the window for splenic rupture has been estimated to be between 2 to 21 days. This is made up. By the way. Yeah. So they recommend that after 3 weeks, you can return to non-contact sports. And after 4 weeks, you can return to contact sports. Again, this is mostly made up. Mainly because the clinical assessments of the spleen are prone to large errors. If you were going to do this right, you would have serial exams with the same sort of evaluator over and over and over again to detect pathological enlargement and relatively small changes, because the reliability between clinicians is poor. Plus, there's a risk of like over-vigorous palpation. Imagine if you had like a med student going in there and just mashing on somebody's spleen.
Yeah. And yeah, admittedly, the spleen exam is one that I would say is pretty challenging for most people these days, unless you're seeing somebody with, you know, leukemia or something like that, that has just an absolutely massive spleen. Those are sometimes hard to miss. But much more of the time when we try to examine for the spleen, very often people don't find it. I would not trust the serial examination of different clinicians to monitor this over time in 2024, for sure.
Yeah, so there's been this thought to use ultrasound to actually,
That's very easy to do and to measure the dimensions of it, although there's still going to be some error in that as well, but much better than palpation would be, I imagine.
Yeah, one study using ultrasound to measure individuals with infectious mononucleosis, measure their spleen size compared to those with another viral infection but no mononucleosis, found that all individuals who had infectious mononucleosis had enlarged spleens compared to those controls with the other infections. Interestingly, though, another study found that almost 10% of healthy athletes also had a spleen that would be considered large. And so there's
just
some
standard anatomic variation for sure. That's completely unsurprising to anybody who's, who knows anything about this stuff for sure.
Yeah. So evidence of rupture should be looked for if the patient has like this acute abdominal pain. And in this particular case, the patient had apparently some free intraperitoneal blood that probably irritated the diaphragm, which is supplied by cervical nerves 3, 4, and 5, so C3, C4, C5, which can lead to the referred pain to the shoulder known as Kerr's sign. That's mostly C4, but it can be other places in the shoulder, the scapula, for example, or the front of the shoulder and chest. In hemodynamically stable patients, those people who are not like bleeding or have like rapidly falling blood counts or whatever, non-operative management should basically be considered unless otherwise needed. So I think my summary diagnosis for this patient is that he had a splenic rupture as a consequence of splenomegaly from infectious mononucleosis, which may have occurred due to high intra-abdominal pressure secondary to the Valsalva maneuver that he used while deadlifting heavy, or it could have been spontaneous. We don't really know because, again, half of these sort of ruptures are spontaneous, but he does have an inciting event. So I don't know. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think it's plausible. The other possibility that I could envision is whether how he was setting down his deadlift, if it was very aggressive, if he was bouncing his deadlift. Those are all things that I could imagine, like, jostle your spleen around a little bit, and if it's already unhappy and prone to doing this. But yeah, I mean, interesting case, certainly another uncommon kind of manifestation, but maybe for the med student learners among the audience, you can see how the thought process goes, and in particular, how, just like with the other cases, you know, we had this scenario and expected to find something abnormal on his shoulder exam, but didn't. And so then that led me to, you know, think, okay, this is not fitting. Got to think more broadly what else can cause shoulder pain. And then that led us down that other pathway to look much more broadly. And then the last thing, I guess, that I did, if I could analyze my own thinking, is just the suddenness of the symptoms is what made me think not just that he could have had mono with an enlarged spleen, but rather that he had mono, enlarged spleen, and it ruptured, because that's the thing that would lead to sudden pain rather than just like this vague, maybe gradual onset kind of discomfort. So the timeline was useful to get the correct answer there. So
yeah, man.
People are getting a window. This is what I do with the rest of my time when I'm at the hospital with my residents. So fun crossover here.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, I was like, all right, so this is our first, you know, episode of the Case Files. What do you think? Do you like this format, Austin?
I mean, this is going to be my new favorite podcast format, because this is what I enjoy doing the rest of the time too. So let's do it, man.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if like you're like, dude, I do this the rest of my life.
Oh,
I don't want to do it on the podcast. Yeah, yeah. All right, let's relate it to exercise. No. Maybe you'll get some fun clinical cases to present to your med studs and learners.
Yeah, mystery cases are always fun, and I imagine that. Well, I don't know. You might know better than me just how many exercise-related case reports you have to choose from, or if we have to broaden it out to some other stuff too, potentially other supplementation or weird nutrition things that people have done, whatever else.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of interesting case reports here. A lot of them are ingestions, obviously, with like various supplements, pre-workout, sure, stuff like that. A lot of them are trauma, you know, like patient dropped something on themselves and had this weird sort of, result. But I'm trying to blend everything together. Like, I don't want to just do only traumas, just only do ingestions. I want a little bit of everything here. So
wow. That was fun. Enjoyed it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, look.
What people think.
Yeah. Let's see what the audience thinks. Hey, you guys like this? Let us know in the comments if there's comments here or, you know, whatever. You can let us know. We're readily available. But thank you so much for listening to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Again, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. A special shout out to Dr. Austin Baraki for bringing his clinical knowledge to the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check.
Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.